Like to call the House State Affairs Committee to order. The time is 3:15 p.m. on Tuesday, February 3, 2026, and we're here in room 120. Please mute your cell phones today. Representatives present include Representative St. Clair, Representative Holland, Representative Vance, Vice Chair Story, and myself, Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business. Our record secretary today is Lori Rowland, and our moderator from the Juno LIO is Jude Augustine, or Zachary Lawhorn, actually. Sorry, Zach. And our committee aide for today's hearing is my staff, Stuart Relay. Thank you to all of you for helping us today. On today's agenda, we do have four items. We'll have a first hearing on House Bill 202 on establishing a state vegetable from Representative Johnson. Then we'll have a continued discussion and complete our presentation from the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority for House Bill 124. And then we will have two resolutions today. First will be House Resolution 6 from Representative St. Clair on celebrating USA's 250th anniversary. And additionally, a first hearing on House Concurrent Resolution 9, which is also on the same topic from our office. So with that said, we've just been joined by Representative Himshue as well. So I would like to invite Representative Johnson and her staff to the committee table. And please go ahead and begin your presentation. Just for committee members' awareness too, we will have a committee substitute that after this presentation we will adopt at the request of the sponsor. So just to give folks an awareness. And we've just also been joined by Representative McCabe. Thank you.
All right. Am I on? All right, very good. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today to present HB 202, which is the act designating the giant cabbage as official state vegetable for the state of Alaska. And you would say, well, what other possible vegetable could it be? You know, I've had a number of people maybe come up with things like.
Introduce yourself. Oh, for the record, introduce
yourself. Oh, excuse me. I think for the record, my name is Delana Johnson. I represent the Palmer area. And just so everybody knows, that is also where the home of the Alaska State Fair, which also has a lot of connection to the cabbage. So, this isn't a very long bill. Let's try to count the words, maybe five, probably the most significant five or six words of legislation this year. This bill was brought to me by a local resident, Richard Estelle. Richard is one of my favorite people. Richard's mother was the original cooperative extension agent that was hired to come up with the Alaska, with the Matanuska Colony Project. And I hope people learn how to can and take care of their goods and so on. So she was a hired personnel of the Matanuska Colony Project. And his father was one of the PhD scientists that came with the Alaska, with the Matanuska Colony Project. And as it would be, that they found that they fell in love, got married. And at that time, because those were two government jobs, one of them had to quit their job, and that was his mother. But that was a federal government requirement of that colony. And so anyway, Richard is a wonderful constituent and thought this and works at the Palmer Visitor Center and would like to for me to bring this bill forward. And I feel privileged to do so. Some things about the cabbage. Well, first of all, the first cabbage way off of the fair was in 1935, the first state fair. It may have been the 1936. And so they've had the cabbage way off at the state fair. And an Alaskan cabbage has been the largest cabbage in the world every year that they've had us way off. There was a couple of years during World War II, they did not have the giant cabbage way off in Alaska. And but other than that, that's been one of the showpieces there at the state fair. There has been a gentleman in Wales that's tried to beat our record, but has never been quite able to pull it off, although I'm keeping an eye on him to make sure that he doesn't come up with some other kind of way, other variety to beat us at. Anyway, many states have a vegetable. Alaska does not have a state vegetable. It's really a marketing piece. It's about talking about our agriculture. It's about showcasing something that that's special and different about the agriculture in Alaska. So that is was one of the main, you know, it's one of the main reasons to have a state vegetable and so on. So as far as agriculture goes, we have about 91 million in agricultural products. It's from about 1,170 farms are each year. That's produced about $91 million in agriculture products at about 1,170 farms. And many of those farms, a lot of these farms, they're not like the farms in the rest of the country. Most of them are smaller. We just don't have these huge, large tract industrial farms in Alaska. They're oftentimes family-owned farms. They grow a wide range of crops, including the green cabbage. Cabbages are a centerpiece of the agricultural attractions at the Alaska State Fair, which I just talked about, and have had worldwide media attention, and I hopefully will have some photos to show you that. In fact, the current Guinness World Book of Records holds largest green cabbage was 138.25 pounds and grown in 2012. We have a state bird, we have a state fish, we have a state dog, we have a state mammal, a state flower, a tree, and I think we have a state rifle. I don't have that on my list, but we do not have a state vegetable. So I would bring this forward to highlight our success in agriculture in Alaska and highlight the produce that we cultivate here. And in that case, there's none more iconic than this globally recognized vegetable, the giant green cabbage. And again, we have 16 other states that highlight their vegetables this way. There's turnips, there's onions, and so on. But I think it's high time that Alaska joins the other states with the giant green cabbage and showing our state's official living insignia. So with that, that's my official presentation. I have a lot more fun things I could talk about, and I think maybe my staff has that. There's been questions, well, why not the carrot? Well, you know, carrots get up to all kinds of things. You can't see them all the time underground. Cabbage is certainly out there, well-known and well-represented. There was a question about a kelp one time. I said, well, that's a seaweed. Come on. Our state seaweed, although it could maybe act as a vegetable at times. So anyway, I look forward to having you all listen to this bill, and I appreciate the time that you take out of your the seriousness of the legislature to have a little bit of fun today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I know we have a couple of slides here. Did we want to go through those before we take a couple questions?
Yeah, I will go ahead and do that. I was going to say good afternoon, Madam Chair, esteemed members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrew Evans. I am staff to Representative Johnson. If it pleases the committee, I will read a very short sectional, and then we do have a brief little presentation for you. House Bill 202, the sectional is as follows. Section 1 amends AS 44.09 to add a new section. Section 4409055, which would establish the giant cabbage as Alaska's official state vegetable. Section 2 sets an immediate effective date under AS 0110070, Section C. And I do have a short little presentation. Some of this is probably going to be something that the representative already went over here, but we'll go ahead and do it. And I just want to be clear, I have nothing on seaweed for anybody.
I do.
Okay, so vegetable cultivation in Alaska actually began in the 1870s and expanded to the Tanana Valley in the 1920s. In 1935, with the establishment of the Matanuska Colony in Palmer, actual sustainable agriculture became firmly established in Alaska. Today, Alaska produces millions of dollars in agricultural products for more than 1,100 farms, but the most iconic of these crops is the giant green cabbage. These cabbages are centerpiece at the Alaska State Fair and garner worldwide media attention. In fact, the current Guinness World Record for the largest green cabbage ever grown belongs to a 138.25-pound giant cabbage grown in Palmer in 2012, and that record stands right through to today. 16 other states, in fact, showcase their agriculture with official vegetables ranging from the Washington's Walla Walla sweet onion to the gillfeather turnip of Vermont. But Alaska, of course, has an official state bird, dog, fish, flower, mammal, and even a tree. But we have no official state vegetable representative of our long history of success in agriculture. Of all the produce grown in Alaska, there really is none more iconic than our giant green cabbage. Thank you for listening to that, and I'm here for any questions.
We do have a couple of questions, Representative McCabe and then Hemshoot.
Thanks. Yeah, through the chair, less of a question and more of a comment. Where's the samples? I mean, this is state affairs. We don't pass bills without samples.
I do not. Pardon me. For the record, Andrew Evans, staff to Representative Johnson. I actually thought about bringing some corned beef and cabbage to the committee, but I thought better of it, I guess.
Follow-up?
Follow-up?
So I think I just heard an invite for St. Patrick's Day in the minority leader's office. Perfect.
I will
Absolutely.
Be cooking, sir.
You will fortunately have one more opportunity, I believe, to bring samples to the House State Affairs Committee. So
we can make that happen.
We can accomplish that.
Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. I had some concerns about this bill through the chair. We don't get giant cabbages in Southeast due to our soil conditions. Our cabbages don't become giant. So I was thinking, is this really representative of the whole state? And then I realized it really is. And so I've kind of embraced the cabbage. And so I might amend the bill, given the chance, to include the requirement for a lapel pin for the legislature featuring the giant cabbage. I was just curious if the sponsor had any...
You know, they call it the stinking rose. That's another name for the cabbage. I think it could be almost a flower. It could be a lapel pin. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So I might have to put an amendment into, but I'm afraid you'll pick up a fiscal note if I do that. So I'm still thinking about what to do, but appreciate the thoughtfulness in your bill. Thank you.
I would just note, too, that the lapel pins are a ledge council thing. And so if we want to do a new legislative pin that's a cabbage, there is actually a mechanism for that. And just for the record, for those listening online, Representative Hemshoot is currently holding up a couple of potential lapel pin designs.
One is a cabbage, universal to the state. We got the whole state covered right here. But if we want to go giant cabbage, which I'm curious if you guys can pronounce the scientific name. But anyway, if you go giant cabbage, then you got to have the wheelbarrow for context.
Thank you for the questions and for the levity today. It's really nice to have. I think at this time we're going to go ahead and roll out the committee substitute, which, just for a head nod on the record here, the sponsor has requested from us for this legislation. So could I get a motion from the vice chair, and then my committee aide will just mention what the change is after we introduce it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the State Affairs Committee adopt CS for HB 202, also known as 34-LS0753/N, as our working document.
And I'm going to object and ask Stuart Relay to just tell us what the, our committee aide to tell us what the change is. And thank you, Representative Johnson and Mr. Evans.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Stuart Relay, staff for Representative Carrick. The summary of changes, it updates the scientific name. The committee substitute updates the scientific name. The names are spelled out in your summaries of changes, and I am not good at Latin, so I will let all of you read the name changes. But now it's the correct version. I will leave it at that and happy to take any questions.
I'm just going to go ahead and remove my objection. Is there any objection to adopting the CS? Seeing none, House Bill 202, version N, has been adopted as our working document. With the CS adopted, we're going to go ahead and move to public testimony, and so we'll open that. I see no public testimony online or in the room on House Bill 202, so we will go ahead and close public testimony. Is there any additional discussion on House Bill 202? Vice Chair Story.
Yes, thank you, Chair Carrick. I just wanted to point out that there are letters of support for the cabbage being our state vegetable.
Thank you for that note. Yes, there are several letters of support in your packet. Additional comments, Representative Vance?
I just want to thank the sponsor of the bill moving this forward. She is definitely the one that that sees the value of these marketing approaches and would like to just also make note of past history of how she prioritized getting Elizabeth Peredovich minted on a coin and telling that story for Alaska and for our civil rights. So this, again, you never know where the cabbage is going to go.
I think we're all looking forward to the lapel pins, too.
Do you brief these for a second?
House State Affairs is back on the record. We just took a brief at ease, and just to briefly summarize those comments, there was some discussion about moving House Bill 202 along today, and there seems to be some pretty strong support for the legislation, so we are going to go ahead and do that. And seeing no further discussion, is there any further discussion or comments? Seeing none, I'm going to turn to Vice Chair Story for a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House State Affairs Committee move 34-LS0753/N as amended with attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection, House Bill 202 version N has been moved from committee. I'll take a very brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Thank you. House State Affairs is back on the record, and next on our agenda, we have continued discussion on House Bill 124, the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority Bill from my office. Today, we are just going to continue the presentation that we had to hold over from a previous hearing with Executive Director Randy Raro and finish that presentation today. I just want to thank Mr. Raro for and staff, Edra Moreledge is here in the room as well, for being flexible with the committee on scheduling the continuation of this presentation. And thank you for being available for us today. As I recall, when we were last hearing the presentation, we had left off on slide 16. And just for the committee's awareness, we do have one other item on our agenda today. So we will need to conclude the presentation and discussion on House Bill 124 today by 4:45. So we have about an hour. And Mr. Raro, if you'd like to go ahead and continue our presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Randy Ruaro, R-U-A-R-O. I am the executive director for ADA, the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. Page 16 of the presentation, Chair, is simply an example of numerous projects that ADA has financed or funded in some way across the state of Alaska, and our projects span from the far southeast corner from Ketchikan, the shipyard, all the way to the North Slope and down to Southwest Alaska. And we're working on projects now that would expand our presence out to the chain, Aleutian Chain as well, and other locations. So geographically, we have a fairly significant reach throughout the state, although we are working on a stronger presence in Southwest Alaska and the Aleutian Chain, largely through some energy projects, renewable energy projects. The geothermal potential of the chain is pretty significant. We're working on a couple projects in the chain, other locations in Alaska. So slide 17.
And we're going to pause really quick. Mr. Ruaro, I'm going to try to say that right from now on. We have a question from Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair. Mr. Ruaro, I'm curious if there is available to us, particularly in light of the context of this bill we're working on, an accounting of all of the assets of the authority and the status of those different loans and other instruments that you've entered into. I noted that under AS 4488205, that would be available to us by January 10th. I've gone through the report that was submitted on the 10th and did not notice there this complete accounting of all the assets. I did also go to the BDO financial reports that were linked and published there, and again did not see list of all the assets. So I'm wondering if those are available, and if so, where we can go to find those, or could you make those available to us?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Holland, I can provide the committee with the letter that was transmitted to the Senate and House clerks that is separate from the annual report and separate from the financial audit that did walk through our assets, and I can also perhaps provide another summary that with a little more detail that breaks down between the different loan programs, the IGU loan, different categories, so I may be able to help clarify a lot of that even beyond what was provided to the House and Senate clerks. But I will get that document into the committee aid today.
Can I follow up?
Follow up.
That's great and very helpful. Thank you for that. It would be helpful, I don't know, you know, if it's convenient, if any of that could be updated. I noticed that what was available, and I believe in those documents, were from the end of June of last year. If there's an update through the end of the year, that would be helpful. And in particular, I'm curious, as you consider being able to provide that list, if we can see both what is committed and any terms in terms of when those agreements or contracts will be completed, so that we can understand the status of outstanding investments that you have. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Holland can definitely provide the information in that format that you described. We have projects that are committed that are in progress, mainly the Alyeskim loan, the Hex Cook Inlet revolving loan, and some other LPP projects that are in progress, the Wild Birch Hotel and others. So I can definitely provide a breakdown in the format. Yeah, you request.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks, through the chair, Mr. Raro. So Ada's fiscal year follows the same fiscal year as the state. So the end of June would be the end of the fiscal year. So that, I assume, is what you're reporting on when you drop the report.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, that's correct. I can provide the update, I think, fairly quickly.
Follow up. So thanks, and through the chair, Mr. Raro. So it would it be fair to say that if you are in negotiations for other projects right now, bar the Alyeskim, which has all been publicly, some of that stuff that we were asking you to provide might be sort of close hold or sort of maybe not wanting to be out in the public because the maybe the business doesn't want their LPP loan to be known?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, we do have a pipeline of projects that are under review, under scrutiny, due diligence. Some of those project sponsors probably would prefer their projects remain confidential. Others are okay with the project being publicly made aware of, the project being made aware to the public. So it's a bit of a mixed bag there, but we do have right now a very robust pipeline of potential projects that include everything from geothermal to hydroelectric to small business loans, you know, our whole gamut of programs. So we have a lot of projects in that pending form right now.
Thanks. And one more follow-up, if that's all right.
One more follow-up.
Thank you. So, yeah, I appreciate that. I can understand a small business that's angling for a loan might not necessarily want it to be out in the public or, you know, because of our meddling. So final question is, when was the last time, and this is based on some public comment that came last week, when was the last time that the state general fund ever gave Ada any money from grants or, you know, from us to Ada?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, the last occasions that I can recall were probably, I think, 12 to 15 years ago for the Ambler Road project. And then after that, I think more recently, perhaps 2018, 2019, there were some funds appropriated for the West Susitna Road.
Thanks.
Representative Holland, and then after this question, we're going to go through a few slides before we take questions again.
Great. Thank you, through the chair. And I want to clarify, I think Mr. Raro understood my request, but to clarify, because of this recent discussion we had, the update I was looking for through the end of the year are going to be for executed investments. I was separately later going to ask for a separate report outlining the pipeline, because I would like to understand what is in the pipeline. I do understand the nature of the confidentiality, and again, under 4488-205, there's some criteria there. So I'm not looking for names of individual firms and anything that would be disclosing anything, but to the degree that this statute also says that we have to annually review the authority's assets to determine whether or not it has the authority required to fulfill the purposes of the authority, we kind of need to also see what's in the pipeline in addition to what's already been deployed. So it was actually two requests. One is for executed deals so we can see the status of what's been obligated, because it's not very apparent from the financial statements. And secondly, the pipeline, but with attention in the pipeline reporting to maintain confidentiality, but I'd still like us to be able to see, as it relates to the bill's intent to perhaps change the amount of total capitalization that the authority has, we need to know what they're invested in and what the pipeline of future investments might be in order to actually answer the question of how much should their capitalization be and whether or not the current amount is sufficient or not. So thank you for giving me a chance to clarify that request.
Through the chair, Representative Holland, if it's okay with the committee and the chair, I can provide a pipeline summary that rather than referring to or identifying individual project sponsors, that categorizes the project as a renewable energy project / geothermal or oil and gas, the North Slope. I can try to categorize it that way.
Thank you, Mr. Raro, and feel free to continue.
Sure. So slide 17, Chair, is some examples of healthcare projects or projects in the healthcare field that Beta has participated in, some large projects, the Blood Bank, the YK Health Corporation project, the Chief Andrew Isaac Health Center in Fairbanks. So we've been active in that category of projects as well. Slide 18 is the Ambler Access Project. This project has been around decades. Frankly, Congress decided in 1980 that there should be a access corridor from the Dalton Highway to the Ambler Mining District. The area has been mined for decades, I think, starting around the turn of the previous century, and lots of historical records finding minerals in that district. And so when Congress got to ANILCA in 1980, it was one of the few mines that the Congress said specifically in a section that there shall be access. It was not a discretionary access right. It was a there shall be access language in section 201 of ANILCA. So that project, ADA's worked closely with local communities and tribes. There's several resolutions of support, I think, in the committee files. We do visit those communities. We hold meetings in those communities, and we usually, after the meeting, we'll usually do a dinner, an event in those communities. So the financial side of that is significant state revenue. Perhaps more importantly, the average wage of a miner is, I think, up to around $130,000 a year, which would make, you know, jobs, particularly for those communities close to the project that have high unemployment, low employment participation rates, make those jobs particularly important for those communities, some of which, you know, anecdotally have, you know, unemployment rates running into the 70s or 80%. Levels. So that's the Ambler project. Slide 19 is the ANWR project. This one in Congress in 2017 and the Tax Cut and Jobs Act directed the Department of Interior to hold the lease sales in ANWR. Congress has again heeded that requirement for the Department of Interior to hold, I think, four more sales. ADA, recognizing the value of the oil and gas in ANWR, stepped up and bid on the leases. We have some preliminary reports from our geologists that the leases hold 4 billion barrels of oil recoverable and 7 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. Of course, it's in a remote spot of Alaska, and so we have to spend significant funds not only confirming the resource with 3D seismic, but we have access and pipeline and other things that we'll need to find a partner with to develop those reserves. But the revenue or estimated revenue, and these numbers from the Biden administration SEIS, NEPA document, was, you know, roughly between taxes and royalties at $2 billion a year. So very significant oil deposits there, and we're excited about hopefully developing those leases. And we do work with Kaktovik, talk to the only community in ANWR. They support us. and they support development in Anwar. Slide 20 is the West Susitna Access Project. This is a project that I believe it was 2019 or 2020. The legislature gave ADA funding and direction to develop this road. This road reaches into the Yetna Mining District. It also provides recreational access and access to borough selected lands for housing and other things. So this road accesses several mines and would provide recreational access and access for housing and other things for this project. Slide 21 is
Mr. Raro, we're actually going to pause on slide 20 here and go to Representative McCabe for questions on any of the last couple slides.
Yeah, thanks. So through the chair, Mr. Raro, I'm just kind of wondering, I know that, let's see, I think I have been to at least 20 meetings on the West Susitna Access. Probably six of them were at the Big Lake Community Council. I know you've had meetings at various places for people, and some of the commenters the other day were commenting that you hadn't had, that you don't have any meetings. So maybe if there are more meetings, public input meetings coming up for the West Susitna Access, you could provide us with a list of those so that we could somehow get those out into the open so that the commenters that said that you don't provide meetings or input or meaningful public input would realize that maybe it's just a communication, or maybe they're not watching the correct spot. That would be appreciated. So when can you kind of highlight where you're at right now on the West Susitna Access for some of my constituents who might be watching, as far as seemed to me you did some sort of a surveying last summer, if I'm not mistaken.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, it's correct that engineers and field work have been ongoing for this project, design, location of bridges, outreach to some stakeholders. There will be a core permit application has been filed, and there'll be a formal declaration, I guess, or public notice by the Army Corps that they're officially starting their permit process. And at that point, there'll be not only public participation opportunities through ADA, but there'll be public participation opportunities through the Corps. And that's the usual case for our resource development projects. There's a number of permits that have to be obtained from both federal and state agencies. And so you'll have public hearings and notices ongoing through multiple avenues for these projects. Thanks.
Follow-up?
Thanks. So one follow-up. I appreciate it, Mr. Raro. So this is all on borough land, I believe. It's not even on state land. And I know about the EPA and all the permits, but and the Corps of Engineers. But maybe the one thing I don't know, there's the wetlands. I think I was told once it was 1% of the entire project crosses or covers wetlands. Is that right, or is it 10%? I can't remember.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative McCabe, most of the land that the project runs across and accesses is actually state land. There's some borough land at Alexander Creek, some borough selections, and then as far as federal jurisdictional wetlands, the U.S. Supreme Court case in Sackett greatly reduced the footprint of federal wetlands to several hundred acres, I believe.
Thank you.
Representative Himshute.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. Through the chair, Mr. Raro, I'm back on slide 18 with the Ambler Access Project. And we heard in public testimony a lot of folks who are concerned about this road being open to the public versus being private. And it seems like there were guarantees given that the road would be private. How do we achieve that? How is a road made public versus made private? Is that through legislation, or how can we guarantee for those folks who've been told it will be private that it is private?
Sure. Through the Chair, Representative Hemshoot, I think there's probably three layers of assurance that the road will be kept at an industrial access and limited commercial access only. And the first layer is the NEPA permitting process, which, you know, the permitting, the road starts on federal land. That permitting process resulted in a formal agency decision by the BLM that the road would be limited access. That limited access designation was then adopted by President Trump and incorporated in his decision allowing access to go forward. That decision is not subject to appeal under the ANILCA statutes. And so we have now an agency decision and a presidential decision that says the road will be limited access. And the third layer of assurance is, frankly, that the project, the road has to run through several segments of private land held by Doyon Nana, the Northwest Arctic Borough, and I think there might be one more landholder, but to my knowledge, none of those entities have agreed to allow anything but limited access and limited commercial access over across their land for the road. So several layers of protection, I guess, to make sure the road is limited access, industrial and commercial use. And if there's a medevac need, that is another use that is allowed.
Follow up?
Thank you. Thanks for that answer. And then through the chair, my follow-up question is, do we know what this road will cost? Like, there's all kinds of benefits spelled out here, but what's the cost of the road? And who pays it?
Sure. So through the chair, to the cost of the road, we have some really only rough estimates anywhere from between $500 million and $1 billion. And what really will happen is that this year we're hoping to get out in the field and take geotechnical surveys of and drill samples of the bridge sites, particularly the large bridge sites. And depending on the results of those geotechnical samples, the engineers will be able to design bridges and give us cost estimates. Those estimates are going to be critical to determining, you know, or producing a very solid cost estimate for the entire project. But we're hoping to get out in the field, get that geotechnical work done, and then be able to provide everyone with a much firmer cost estimate for the road. In terms of who pays for the road is intended to follow the Red Dog model, which is ADA would not advance with the project until the mine companies had agreed and provided assurances that they will back the cost of the road, whatever the financing vehicle is. So regardless of whether at that point the mines go forward or not, ADA would be assured that the mines would cover the cost of the project. So we won't advance it until we have those types of assurances similar to the Red Dog Road.
Follow-up?
Thank you. One more follow-up. Through the chair, a concern that I've heard in my district for projects across the state, so a lot of these are ADA projects, but not all of them, for example, TAPS, at the community level when I was on the assembly, anytime we leased land and somebody wanted to develop something, there had to be some kind of a bond in place for removing the infrastructure or returning the area to the state it was in prior to their use. So I keep hearing it's a temporary road and it will be taken out or whatever. What's the guarantee of that? Is there some kind of bond, or how do we know that the road, in this case, the road, but really all projects that ADA is funding, if they're not considered permanent, what's the method for guaranteeing that those will be, so to speak, cleaned up?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, ADA will follow the existing federal rules for federal lands on reclamation and bonding, and will follow the state rules as well on state lands for reclamation and bonding. So that issue or that cost of reclaiming the road will be managed through those existing statutes and requirements.
Thank you.
I don't see any additional questions at this time, Mr. Ruaro. If you want to continue, I think let's maybe hold the rest of our questions until we've completed the presentation, and then we can take questions for as long as we have time for after that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Slide 21 is a slide on the Ketchikan Shipyard. This is a facility in Ketchikan that ADA's owned for several decades, receiving it from DOT at some point in the past. We recently changed operators from a company called Zigger to a company called JAG Marine, and they have increased business and jobs from roughly 15 jobs, I think, when they took over the property to 150 now. And we're working with Sea Alaska and Tlingit Haida and some other facilities to create a training pipeline to get locals into those jobs as much as we can. We're also looking at a potential home porting or at least the ability to haul out the fast response cutters and the middle-sized, medium-class icebreakers, of which the commandant of the Coast Guard in a committee hearing to Senator Sullivan just last week said he's looking at home porting four more medium-class icebreakers in Alaska. So we're hoping to be able to add some improvements to the shipyard that would allow those icebreakers and fast response cutters to be hauled out in Ketchikan and maintenance work done there. We estimate, rough estimate is that could add another 150 jobs. So we might be able to go from 15 jobs just a few months ago to 300 in 2 years. Slide 22 has some energy projects that ADA's involved in, the Interior Energy Project, IGU. We've been working with them. We just financed not too long ago the purchase of the LNG trucks. They're now trucking from the slope versus taking gas out of the inlet. That provides about 1.5% of total demand needs out of Cook Inlet back to South Central. And then Cook Inlet, Hex Fury, is a company that ADA's established a revolving loan fund for. They just drilled two successful wells this last year. I think they're up from bankruptcy under a previous owner and zero production. I think they're now up to 12% of all production out of the inlet with ADA's financing. And we think if they're successful this next year, they can be up to 20%. So very significant gas production from Hex Cook Inlet. They're doing great. We're also looking into projects. These would be pipeline projects, but we're looking into other projects that are transmission or renewable energy projects, geothermal, hydroelectric. And I'll add those to the list that Representative Holland asked about. Slide 23 is just a representation of how the dollars flow in an ADA project. So the Red Dog Mine project produces, has produced, I think, nearly $2 billion in 7I, 7J funds revenue sharing because the project is on NANA land. So those funds flow through all the other Native corporations and assist them in their operations. 800 to 1,000, I think, shareholder jobs annually, $50 million a year at least in wages. We have a village improvement fund that's been very helpful for the small communities. And, of course, the Northwest Arctic Borough's PILT arrangement with Tech, I think, produces almost 80% of their annual budget at roughly $25 million a year. Most of that, I think, goes to schools. But this is an example of how ADA's investments can produce benefits that probably aren't measured solely in financial return to ADA, but they do accomplish our statutory mission of creating economic development and jobs. Slide 24 has some emerging investment areas that we're looking into, data centers, AI edge computing. That's a project that we're working on in Cordova with a company called GreenSpark. That project, when up and running, would absorb some excess hydro capacity in the community and at the same time provide revenue for the community and bring down energy costs for the people in Cordova. So that's a model, just like Red Dog's a model. The Cordova Edge Data Center model is something that we'd like to try to repeat in other communities. We're working with AML to try to get some data from other communities on whether they have excess hydro or excess energy, and would be a good potential target for repeating that project. We're looking into geothermal energy, Mount Augustine, and others in the chain, solution chain. Methanol is a product that can be made from natural gas. That we just closed the funding with Alyeskim for a new methanol plant on the North Slope, and we're looking at opportunities for marine methanol in other locations if AKLNG moves forward, which we think it will, and ready to build other projects off of that gas supply. That's it for those slides on projects, Madam Chair. My next few slides are my comments on how Ada would be affected by HB 124, and I can proceed with those if that's the will of the chair.
Yeah, do we have any questions before we go into those last couple slides? Okay, Representative Holland.
Great, thanks. Ms. Rauer, I just wanted to follow up. I planned on talking about kind of the pipeline at this point, but we got into that a little bit earlier. But with regard to the state's adopted Comprehensive Economic Development Strategy, which identifies a state-level set of strategies around economic diversification and areas of investment, and, you know, I think you and I have chatted before about the idea of Ada perhaps being able to help leverage, catalyze, and grow the early stage business opportunity so that we can have more Alyeskims in the world. I'm just wondering, what are your views right now on how we might do more to use the resources that Ada has to significantly invest in those diversification and emerging sector efforts? You know, Ada gets a lot of attention because of its major projects in kind of the engines, as the SEDS would refer to them. But I think we both realize that there's a lot more work we could be doing to create a lot more earlier stage businesses and the velocity of that. What's your current strategy or the board's thoughts on how to use the assets that you have to both align with the SEDS plan, but, you know, perhaps lean into increasing the velocity, quantity, and quality of early stage businesses so that there's a better pipeline for more of your established products at later stages?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So through the chair, Representative Holland, the board has just recently approved a subsidiary of Ada, which we're allowed to own subsidiary company. It's a tech subsidiary, which is focused on being able to vet and review and hopefully promote businesses engaged in tech activities from AI to quantum, whatever it is that they're working on. And so we've just stood that up recently. I think that could be helpful. I think Ada should participate, find other partners to work with for people with ideas and small businesses. You know, those ideas are going to come faster and faster and faster with AI. I mean, I think you can almost literally come up with a question or a business thought, plug it into AI, and the research, you know, that used to take months, you know, may be able to just come back to you in minutes. And so I think we do need to work, Ada does need to work with partners, beyond the tech subsidiary, and set up a central location, I guess, almost incubator site, I guess, where Alaskans with ideas can submit those and try to advance those to grow a business. I think that would be excellent.
Follow up?
Great. Thank you for that. That's interesting and good news. I wonder, do you have or can you share information about that new subsidiary strategy, perhaps as a follow-up to this discussion today? I'd be interested in learning more when and if that's appropriate to share that.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Holland, I can definitely get you the resolution establishing the subsidiary, and I think we have a public memo on it as well. I'm happy to meet with you and talk about, you know, how that's going to evolve.
Okay. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, Mr. Ruraro, you and I have talked extensively about the loan participation or partner participation LPP program. And I think you told me that there may be as many, more than 1,000 businesses in Alaska that have benefited or are benefiting from that program. I wonder if there's a way to get that list of people that have or businesses that have benefited from that into our hands, if not by name, maybe at least by geographic region. So say if there was, you know, 1,000 businesses in the Big Lake area that had used data successfully, got a loan, bought some equipment, made their business go, and then paid back their loan, which paid back the general fund. Kind of like to know, you know, we hear from public testimony that there's a lack of transparency and people don't know what ADA does, and a lot of misinformation. And it would be helpful to us if we had a list of even a geographic list that would, even for our districts, that would be helpful. Is that possible, do you suppose?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I can check, will check. I have seen reports run of our borrowers before. I'd have to look at the loan agreements to see what it says about disclosing names or information, but I can definitely look at that issue and get back to you.
Yeah.
Follow up.
Thanks. Yeah. I don't want to scare anybody or make anybody nervous that we're going to disclose their loans or anything. So maybe just the aggregate numbers of how many loans, you know, just something to give us an idea so we can take back to our constituents and let them know, you know, how many loans that the Big Lake area has had and how many businesses we've benefited for ADA. And maybe an aggregate amount of money that has come back to ADA from each district.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I will look at that issue and see what the language says about confidentiality and talk to our in-house counsel. And I know we can generate the report. I just have to make sure we're not violating any loan terms.
Thanks.
And Mr. Ruraro, I just want to echo Representative McCabe's request. And again, I don't think the request is for the business names per se or the loan amounts, but just the, I guess, a heat map regionally would be a cool way to see it. Or, you know, if we can say just how many loans we've had in the LPP program by, you know, not even by district, but just by region in Alaska, that'd be really, that'd be great to see. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. If I can just offer a thought on this, to the degree that we can see the amounts, it actually would be helpful. The purpose of this bill is to help us to understand the amount of money that ADA needs in order to do its work. And I genuinely, you know, want to understand what is currently outstanding in loans as opposed to what might have been loaned a couple decades ago. Sometimes, you know, the information we see talks about projects that are very successful, but long since kind of mostly done. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to, I think it would be very useful to have that kind of broader report of all the stuff that was done. But I am specifically trying to get down to brass tacks here in terms of how much money is currently obligated, existing loans that are in place. So I just want to throw that out there. I don't necessarily want to give up on not getting the dollar amounts. Mm-hmm. Not specific, not with names, not with something that's identifiable, but I do think we need to know what's obligated, understand when we go back and look at the balance sheet to know what those numbers mean in terms of how much of the money is actually currently at work in Alaska.
Yeah, I'll leave it to Mr. Ruraro and staff to figure out how best to prepare that list, but numbers would be great. De-identified information is perfectly acceptable, is the gist. I also just want to respond to Representative McCabe regarding, you know, some of the public testimony that I think one of the things I want to highlight, even though this is a bill that one could say clips Ada's wings a little bit, one of the things I want to highlight is some of that, you know, small business development and loan participation program that is working really well within Ada, and just kind of also get Ada's focus more on to those things that have a lot of public support, but maybe the public doesn't really know very much about, other than the folks that have used it. And so I would be very happy to get that information and also just highlight that work that Ada is doing, and has done for a long time around the state. Let's go ahead and we have about 20-ish minutes left to spend on House Bill 124 today. I'd like Mr. Rohrer to get through the slides regarding House Bill 124 and take questions once he's completed that, and then open it up for questions one more time. So I think we're on slide 26.
Right. We, Madam Chair, we are on slide 26. If I could, there's a sections before Section 8 that I'd just like to mention briefly for the committee that Ada would oppose, and one of those is Section 2, which changes up the makeup of the board and puts on to the board a member of a specific environmental group or advocacy group, and also adds on members who are former legislators. But as I read the bill, those individuals would not have to meet the private sector business or industry requirement that's in statute now. And so we have some concerns about that section number two. All board members now are required to make decisions under a reasonable and prudent investor standard, an objective standard, regardless of their background or where they're, what groups they're a member of. So we would recommend that section two be deleted. Section three, this changes up the staggering of the board terms, and then allows for a removal of some board members once some appointments are made would be made by the Speaker or the Senate President. Again, we've got concerns there that that's bringing in some politicization of the board and the decision-making process. So we would oppose Section 3. Section 4 is requiring Ada to adopt personnel rules. But most personnel rules, I can't think of any, exempt Ada now. So from minimum wage to Human Rights Commission to whistleblowers or any of those existing personnel rules for any other state agency do apply to Ada now. And so we're not sure that that's a Section 4 requirement that's needed for Ada. Section 5 talks about the Attorney General filing, whether or not Ada could file a complaint to protect its interests under a contract or a loan or some other agreement. And this is another section that Ada would oppose. We think our in-house counsel and our outside counsel are best suited to make decisions about whether Ada should file a lawsuit. And I can't think of a situation recently where Ada has filed a lawsuit. We have been sued under different lawsuits for different things, but I can't remember Ada bringing a lawsuit or abusing, you know, in some way. It's right now under the statutes to bring a lawsuit. So we would ask that Section 5 be deleted. Section 6 talks about Ada adopting regs by resolution. Don't oppose that language. Talks about Ada responding with written responses to comments on regs. We don't oppose that requirement either. That's something we can do. Section 8 this is probably one of the main sections that will not reform ADA, but stop it from performing its functions entirely. This section requires ADA to sell off roughly $1.2 million in assets, whatever those are, loans, fixed assets, Ketchikan Shipyard, FedEx Hangar, whatever it is. ADA would have to sell those assets by the end of 2026, if I read the effective date right. That type of a sale, forced sale, would result in likely hundreds of millions of dollars in losses. We would then, even if we stayed at the $500 million level of allowed assets, we would then be unable to make any further investments because that could, or even accept a grant, for example, for the shipyard, because that counts as an asset under GASB, and that would put us over the $500 million limit. So we would be stuck not only incurring hundreds of millions in losses, but we would be stuck at being unable to perform, conduct any new loans or business. Section 9 is a section that also we have some serious concerns with. It contains provisions about requiring ADA to get a certified resolution of a political subdivision in which a project is located. And as we see with the Ambler Road, you know, there's multiple political subdivisions. There's probably, I think, 7 or 8 communities within 50 or 75 miles of the road. Some of those support it. We've got resolutions of support into the record on Allakakit and Hughes and Shugnak and Kobuk, Ruby and some others. But, you know, it's very difficult to hit 100%. And there are communities that oppose the project, Evansville, Bettles, Alatna, and some others. So this requirement, if it's applied to require 100% approval, will result in a lot of projects not advancing, even though a majority of the communities with perhaps 90% of the population support the project. So that's Section 9, Sub 1. Section 9, Sub 2 requires ADA to make findings that the project would create jobs and is economically feasible. Those are current requirements that are imposed on ADA now. Finance plan and due diligence, et cetera, all through those current requirements, we have to make those findings now. Section 9.3, ADA would have to compile a study of economic, social, and environmental effects of a project, and that is something we're interested in for sure, and we do work on and study. It's largely done for any resource development project. That's largely done through the NEPA studies of the Army Corps, the BLM, or whatever federal agency is managing the project, and those studies end up being, I think in the case of the Ambler Road, I think there are over 1,000 pages of economic, social, and environmental effects of a project in there. But so the work is, that type of work, that analysis is done. It's just done for, in a way, for ADA, an ADA project, but through a federal agency conducting a NEPA study. Section 9.4 and 9.5 talks about providing information to the legislature. We submit annual reports, audits, and have for decades into the legislature. I was struggling on this section to understand exactly what new information would be provided. So if it's data that is in the reports required now by statute, doesn't see how sections 9.4 and 9.5 are needed. Section 10 is a requirement that prohibits a board member from voting on a resolution if their interest in a lease or contract is direct or indirect. The language currently in statute talks about a direct interest. I couldn't find a definition of indirect interest. So I can't really comment on the effect of Section 10, Section 11 repeals and reimposes a requirement about providing an accounting of assets. Again, it was unclear to me what new requirements are created by Section 11. Section 12 talks about ADA creating and developing missions and measures for performance and measuring that results and getting those into the legislature. I think that would be fine. We should be have missions and measures. I don't know if they're called that anymore. That's what they were back in 2002 when I was working on those with House as of House Finance Aid. But ADA does not object to creating and then reporting on missions and measures for performance. Section 13, I read the language one way. It seemed to require business information, tax information, and other things, financial information, to be considered a public record. What I couldn't tell was whether the normal protections under the public record statute would apply, or if it was just to be considered a public record and you know, anyone who wanted to see it could see it. If that's the case, you know, obviously, you know, a lot of loan and project borrowers and sponsors would be unlikely to come to ADA if they knew their business information would be released. So that's a section I think that could be clarified. Section 14 talks about ADA being able to bring a lawsuit only if approved by the Attorney General. For the reasons I mentioned earlier, ADA drafts its own contracts with in-house counsel. We use out-of-house counsel for reviews as well, and we think we're in the best position to decide, you know, whether to bring a complaint to protect our interests. So we would oppose making that ability subject to the discretion of an attorney general. Section 15 removes the standard protection for every other state employee. I think in every other state in the nation, that if they're doing their job, you know, they're not subject to being sued and held personally liable for some complaint or claim. So this is a section we would urge the committee to remove. We think ADA employees are working hard, doing a great job, and following the rules, and should not be singled out, I guess, for being subject to personal liability for decisions that they make in their capacity. I think the effective date, Section 17, January 1, 2027, what was unclear here, Chair and members, was whether or not projects, investments, things that ADA has under contract now would be subject to the forced sale of assets under Section 8 that would or could result in significant losses and ADA having to breach, you know, a number of contracts. So we're concerned about the effect of that effective date. Projects and funds and investments that are currently under a valid contract are exempted from Section 8. That makes the impact less, but it's still a significant negative impact on ADA. That's my review of the sections, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Roraro, for walking through that. That was a very clear presentation. Let's see. Do we have any questions or comments from committee members? And we have about 10-ish minutes. So Representative Holland, and then we'll go to
great others. Thanks. Two quick questions, just clarifying the statements, just so I can go back later and do some more work on this. In the statement of net position, there's a section referred to as deferred inflows of resources. Could you clarify what is currently being stated under this category of deferred inflows of resources? It looks like it's got $163 million in there. I'm just curious what it is. I tried researching it, but I couldn't get down to the bottom of it.
Sure. Through the Chair Representative Holland, I think our Chief Financial Officer is listening in and may be available to answer that question. If she's not able to jump on right away, would ask the indulgence of the chair and the committee to get a written response in after this.
Okay. The follow-up is fine. The second follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. And the same question, again, fine, if we want to follow up on it. When we look at the statement of revenues, there's a section on non-operating revenues versus operating revenues. I'm assuming non-operating revenues may be other investments and activities, but it would be helpful if you could give us some breakdown of the difference between the two. It looks like the non-operating revenues are, if you take out the dividend to the state, slightly higher than the operating revenues, which I assume are mission-related activities. So if you have a quick thought on that, that's great. If you want to follow up with that, that's fine.
Through the chair, Representative Holland, that's correct. And we will get a specific breakdown to you as part of the follow-up from today's hearing.
And then final
follow-up.
Thanks. And then thank you for that. And through the chair, going back to the statement of net position, and this gets back to the question of this, you know, possible forced sale divestiture in order if we were to try and implement the bill as it currently states. It looks to me, but this gets back to those other reports I think you're going to work on, that there is about $1.05 billion worth of items on the statement of net position that are probably invested funds in different investments, whether that is firm capital equity investments or open loans, which would seem to suggest that there is another almost $600 million that is not invested in anything right now. And that if we were to be looking at some changes in the total capitalization, that I certainly agree that if we went down below what I think is 1.047, 1.05, that would definitely start forcing things to have to get divested of ahead of time. But if in the reports you're going to work on, if you could help us clarify how much of the total 1.75 is actually tied up in things versus what I think is about $600 million that may just be sitting in cash and other investments would be helpful. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Hall, we will definitely get you that breakdown. The amount of money sitting in cash is very low. Most of our funds, over 95%, I would say, are all either working in a project or invested in, you know, bonds, treasury notes, things of that nature. So very little actual cash, I think, comparatively. But we will get you that breakdown, and I'll work with our CFO right after this.
Thank you. Representative McCabe?
Thanks. So, Mr. Raro, staying on the on slide 26 here with the Section 8 and the divesting of 1.2 billion, you said million, I think you meant billion in assets. I want to focus on one in particular, just because I happen to know the details of it. So I want to focus on inlet gas utility, interior gas utility. I keep saying inlet. I don't know why.
It's definitely not an inlet.
I know, right? So the interior gas utility, and I want to highlight this for people that are listening, was a loan that you gave to a company or a entity in the Fairbanks area that is hauling natural gas to Fairbanks to mitigate the PM2.5 and to provide cheaper natural gas or to Fairbanks for heat. And if I remember right, that was $139 million. It was a 35-year loan. The first 15 years were payment and interest free. And the next, the rest of the loan period, which would be 20 years, was at a quarter of a point for payment, if I remember right. So that would be considered a low performing or low hanging fruit for divestiture. If you had to get rid of assets, that would be one of the first that would be part of the fire sale, would be my guess. So how does that work? You sell that to another company, and then they immediately force the IGU to start making payments, or does the in other words, is our meddling here, or is this bill going to create issues for Fairbanks people in heat and in cheap natural gas?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, so if we were forced to sell assets, we would have to do so under the statutory requirement of taking steps that a reasonable and ordinary prudent investor would take. And so we would be organizing our assets in the ranking them from highest performing to least performing. And as you mentioned, by statute, the direction of the legislature, the IGU loan is a very low performing asset by design, you know, by law. It's set in that way, but we would have to analyze it from that objective standard. It would be an asset that we would be forced to see if we could sell or remove from our total assets under this bill. And it's unlikely, I think, that we may not even be able to find a buyer. If we could find a buyer, it would be at a very low value. And that buyer, I'm sure, would be looking at those terms to see if there was a way to force a change in those terms at some point in time and negotiate for a higher rate of return. Otherwise, you know, they would be probably unlikely to want the asset.
Follow up. Thanks. So, I appreciate that. And so you also mentioned some other assets that would probably be on the, as part of what I see as a fire sale. Anytime you take a big financial package or group like you have and are forced to sell assets within a really fixed tight time period, the buyers look at that and they kind of salivate. They look for these great deals. So, I wonder if there's estimates of, could you find a buyer for the Ketchikan, for the power down there or for the shipyard? How would that work? I mean, would you just put it up for sale? You put it on Craigslist or something? Or, it just seems to me that we would be offering these assets up on the chopping block in a fire sale.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, we would reach out to some private investors that may have expressed interest in an asset at some time, but we would be at a disadvantage because they would know that they could simply wait and wait for the deadline to get closer and closer and force, you know, more leverage would become placed on ADA to make a sale. So we would anticipate, you know, pretty low recovery rates on fixed assets and even loans that we would be forced to sell.
Thanks. I appreciate it. One more.
Very brief.
Okay. So should the people that are employed by Snedisham, the power plant and the shipyard and Red Dog Mine, should they be worried for their jobs, would you think, if we should pass this bill?
If, through the chair, Representative McCabe, if the bill passed, it would force ADA into a number of positions. I guess the first position is we would obviously retain legal counsel to take a look at whether the provisions of the bill can actually force ADA to break contracts and sell assets, because the federal constitution prohibits forcing state legislation from forcing an entity to break a contract. So we would, you know, one of the first things we would do is hire the attorneys and start looking at the, constitutionality of the bill. There's also a contract clause protection in the Alaska Constitution. We'd look at that. So, you know, before we gave notice of, you know, great concern to fixed assets, the shipyard, the employees there, we would definitely take a very hard look at the legality of the bill and have to decide whether to challenge it. I think it's likely we would. But it would definitely, you know, I think still concerning for employees of ADA Assets, you know, that this has happened and, you know, the location where they work could be forcibly sold.
We have a couple more questions. I had put myself in the queue, then I have Vice Chair Story and Representative Vance will get the last question today. Mr. Ferraro, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about the Northern Economic Study that the legislature paid $250,000 for. And my understanding is it was released 2 years late. When I looked at it the other day, it was less robust than the ADA annual report for this last year and was about 16 pages long. What can you tell me about why that study was so delayed and why it is so skimpy, for lack of a better word?
Sure. Through the chair, a couple of notes on the Northern Economic Study. What was released was only the executive summary. The full, I guess, study is due any day, and it'll be hundreds of pages long. Part of the delay in getting the study out was because we were trying to address a number of allegations, I guess. I would call it jello, you know, thrown at the wall by the salmon state economists, making claims such as, you know, Red Dog Mine would have happened anyway without ADA. And to push back and present facts on those types of allegations takes a lot more research. And so we were, you know, in that instance, we were calling Vancouver Archives to get business records of Cominco, and the legislative librarian was helping us look up the bill files from 1983, 84, and 85, and then again in 97. And so it just took a lot longer than we had hoped to compile what we think is a good factual representation of ADA, and just drug on. And then we had to update it because it had some time had passed, and we had another annual report or another fiscal year had passed, and we, you know, we wanted to update it to show the current status of ADA. And so it has taken longer. The funding, just to be clear, ADA paid the funding from its own receipts for the study. It was brought about because of the Salmon State report and the desire of the board to have a rebuttal to that report out there. So I'm hopeful that we can get that to everyone this week. We think it's going to show, you know, a very different picture of ADA than what was represented in the other report.
Thank you for that response, Mr. Ferraro. I have a question from that. I mean, is ADA's role with public dollars that was provided to prepare that report, is the role of ADA using those public dollars to provide a report that is 2 years late and is a rebuttal to public groups in Alaska?
Through the chair, it was a policy decision. The funds are all ADA receipts, which by statute are separate from the state treasury. It was a policy decision to try to inform the public, I guess, of accurate facts about ADA. So that was a policy decision that was made. I guess I would say that it was a policy call, but that it is important for the public, you know, to have accurate information when attacked or alleged to have perhaps not met its mission or other things. So I think there will be a significant benefit to the public of having the report completed.
Thank you for that response and for the slight trajectory off of the bill. I appreciate you answering those questions. We have to be fairly quick with the last couple of questions. I've got Vice Chair Story, then Representative Vance. Representative Himshu, you can have the last one.
Will there be another opportunity, or this is kind of...
We will ask Mr. Ferraro to come back and be available for questions. This is kind of our... likely our last opportunity for his direct testimony, but we will definitely invite ADA to be present for the rest of the discussion.
Okay.
or Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. And I wanted to just comment and say that I agree with Rep. Holland's quest to get more information. I think people have been asking for that, and I appreciate Director Raro, your saying that you're going to be having that more thorough information for us. I think one thing that I really wanted to ask was about the public process. As you can read the letters about this bill and Rep. Carrick's attempt in the bill to make sure public comment time is recognized. There's a few suggestions in there just about the public process in general, and I'm sure you have heard some concerns too. And so I am wondering what you feel is should be done, or how your organization is looking at being more responsive to the inquiries for public process. I would appreciate hearing about that.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Story, the public process at ADA, and I can provide a one page of our notice and agenda. We always have at least one opportunity for public comment. That public comment is allocated of a minimum of 2 minutes. It is often the will of the chair to allow some leniency and allow comment to go beyond that time limit. But we do always have a public comment opportunity. Our meetings are publicly noticed, usually at least a month in advance. And frankly, well, I did hear, and I don't doubt the people who testified that they're frustrated with our process. I think it's more a result of the fact that the board doesn't engage in a back and forth public debate with people commenting. They listen and take in the comment, but we're not. I'm not, and the board is not engaging in a public debate over the merits of a project at our meetings. It doesn't mean their public comments aren't important or they haven't been heard. It's just not part of our process to get into that type of a back and forth debate. And I would also add that the nature of our corporation is that our statutory mission is to advance economic development, including the development of our natural resources, and to create jobs. And so, that's the mission of the board and ADA. And so that's maybe at odds with a lot of the people commenting, and they may be frustrated that, they're not feel like they're not heard, that the projects are continuing. But all due respect, that's the mission that we've been given by the legislature, is to create revenue for the state, create jobs, and support economic development. So having that mission, I think that's where the board is going to land in most instances.
Follow up. Thank you for that. And I didn't, I heard some thoughts about why you thought the public maybe didn't feel there was a thorough public process, but I'm wondering if you have if there's a limit on time to how long you hear people for 2 minutes. I'm wondering about the public process of, like, if a technology went down, is it a goal at the next meeting to have more public process time, more public comment time? Are packets posted? Are the letters you get that are pro or con for a project posted? I was looking for sort of those kind of elaborations.
Sure, through the chair. So on the agenda, there'll be a notice for public comment. There's no limit to the length of time that's allowed for public comment. Overall, there's a per commenter limit of 2 minutes, but like I said, it's very common for the chair to just allow some leeway in people to finish their comments. I can also look up some statistics, but I think at many of our meetings, there is no comments. It's not uncommon for no one to show up at our hearings and comment. Other times we do have four or five, so it kind of varies. But our public notice process is always the same. We do post agendas. We do post resolutions in advance of the meetings. We could post the comments themselves, so that's something we could start doing, is just posting the comments as part of the record. They are part of the record, so that is something we could do.
I'll follow up.
One last follow up, and then we're going to go to Okay. One last follow up.
Yes, I guess when I was thinking about, through the chair, I was thinking about the information about the comments being posted, but I was just curious too about the projects and background information that was completed, such as surveys and any environmental things that people are wanting to read and know that those processes were done. Are they put up on the internet or wherever you post them?
Through the chair, we do publicly post and have a lot of information available. For example, we just finished a review of impacts on caribou from the Ambler Road by a biologist, and that results of his study were posted publicly and provided out in a press release. So we do have a fair amount of information out. I'd have to go back and look at each project to see what we have posted, but we do try to get things like that out so the public can read that.
Thank you.
Thank you. I know we have questions from Representative Vance and Representative Himshute. I'd like to invite Mr. Raro back for Thursday's meeting. I believe he will be joining us at that meeting online. We hope so. Anyway, we will make sure that there is an opportunity for members to continue asking questions. For our time constraint today, we are going to set House Bill 124 aside. For members' information, my intention is at our Thursday hearing to bring forward a committee substitute for the committee that my office has been working on, and then use that as our working document for members to then offer amendments to. So we will, at the next hearing on Thursday, bring this bill back forward, continue some committee discussion, and present a committee substitute for consideration, just so folks know what we're doing next. Thank you again to Mr. Raro and to Ms. Morledge for being here today.
Thank you.
So we are setting House Bill 124 aside, and the next item on our agenda, I'm very glad we got to it, is from Representative St. Clair, House Resolution 6, honoring America's, and both of us are going to have to get really good at saying this word, semi-quincentennial. Thank you for being here.
For the record, Steve St. Clair, Representative District 26. House Resolution 6, I'm just going to read the title real quick, and then I'll go into some comments. I know that we're short on time. House Resolution 6, recognize and commemorate the 250th, I'm not going to say that long word, anniversary of the founding of the United States of America, encouraging participation in commemorative events, and encouraging educational institutes to enhance civics education. I was asked by a member from the other body to carry this, and actually it's rather important to me. H.R. 6 is a celebratory resolution that recognizes the birthday of the United States of America, our Constitution, and the founding of our great nation. This resolution is near and dear to my heart as a service member who spent 20 years in the Army. I'm going to read the oath of enlistment for the Army. I, and I state your name, do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, and that I will obey the orders of the President of the United States and the orders of the officers appointed over me according to regulations and the Uniform Code of Military Justice, so help me God. And then recently I took another oath for state representative. I do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Alaska, and that I will faithfully discharge my duties as a representative to the best of my ability. Both of these oaths include the U.S. Constitution as a foundational element. I have never been relieved of my military oath, and I fully intend to uphold my oath for state office. This is a vital resolution that encourages discussion of the United States Constitution and the founding of this great nation.
Thank you very much, Representative St. Clair. And just to add some context, we both saw on the floor about a week or so ago that we introduced the same subject. Both members of this committee, both sitting next to each other, we've both been in communication with our offices and with the other body and have kind of a pathway forward here. So do you have any further comments, Representative St. Clair?
No, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your service and for your presentation. I think that just exemplifies why this is so important. What we have done working together, our two offices, is take a lot of the language from House Resolution 6 and add it to House Concurrent Resolution 9 and made a few other small changes to that resolution to reflect the intent of both of the resolutions. So we are setting House Resolution 6 aside, and we are now going to present a CS, a committee substitute for House Concurrent Resolution 9. Just for the public's awareness listening, a concurrent resolution goes through both bodies, while a Senate resolution goes through just the Senate body and the House resolutions just go through the House body. So procedurally, my office has decided to move forward with House Concurrent Resolution 9 as it is the only resolution right now introduced in either body that must go through both bodies. But I just want to say for House Concurrent Resolution 9 before we present the committee substitute that I'm extremely grateful for both Senator Tilton and Representative St. Clair for also introducing resolutions. I don't think we can have too many of these on this subject because it's a very important subject. And it's a very important recognition, and it's a bipartisan recognition. Celebrating America's greatest milestones is something that belongs to all of us, and it's the heritage we all have as United States citizens. So thank you, Representative St. Clair. I'm going to ask for a motion to adopt the committee substitute for House Concurrent Resolution 9, and I will object after that motion is made so that my staff can describe some of the changes our offices have worked together on. At ease. House State Affairs is back on the record. We only have a few minutes left, so I just want to be really clear. We had noticed two resolutions today, House Resolution 6 from Representative St. Clair, which we've just had a good overview on the semi-quincentennial resolution. We also have House Concurrent Resolution 9 noticed for today for a first hearing, which is on the same topic. It is substantively the same resolution. And we have introduced it for substantively the same reasons. It is an extremely important milestone. The resolution highlights some of the most important reasons why we should reflect on the United States Constitution and the progress that has been made over the course of America's long 250-year anniversary. At this time, I'm going to ask for a motion to adopt a committee substitute on House Concurrent Resolution 9, which substantively merges the resolutions from both offices today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House State Affairs Committee adopt CS for HCR 9, also known as 34-LS109/I, as our WEC, or is it L, or is it 1? Sorry, brief at ease.
Brief at ease. House State Affairs is back on the record. One more time, Vice Chair Story.
Yes,
sorry about that.
I'm good. With the committee's indulgence, I'm just going to say HCR 9, also known as 34-LS1091/I, as our working document.
I think you might want to restate the whole motion again since we were at ease for a moment there.
Okay. Glad to do that. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House State Affairs Committee adopt CS for HCR 9, also known as 34-LS1091/I, as our working document.
Thank you. I'm going to object so that our committee aide can walk through the changes on House Concurrent Resolution 9. Thank you.
Here, work draft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Stuart Relay, staff for Representative Carrick. The summary of changes just kind of outlines the various whereas statements that were included in House Resolution 6 that were then merged in House Concurrent Resolution 9. I could go through all of the listed whereas statements and their changes if that is the indulgence, if the committee would like me to do that. But
Mr. Relay, can you just summarize some of the main additions?
Can we have an Eddie's really quick?
We're back on the record.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize to everybody again for the record. Stuart Relay, staff, Representative Carrick. Whereases from Representative St. Clair's resolution that have been included into House Concurrent Resolution Number 9 just talk about add emphasis to the timeless principles that were included in the Declaration of Independence, including the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It discusses the principle of federalism, which is obviously a very critical component of the United States structure of government and its founding 250 years ago. It talks about the importance of decentralized government. And it adds whereas is again encouraging commemorative activities around the state. It also includes both resolve statements from House Resolution 6 that encourages educational institutions to enhance civics education. And Madam Chair, those are the very broad strokes.
Thank you for that. It's appreciated. And I need to correct myself because it's the anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, not the Constitution. Important distinction for both resolutions. We did have public testimony notice today. I'm going to just quickly open public testimony.
We have to adopt either vote.
Oh, yeah. I'm so sorry. I was getting ahead of my skis there. I was ahead of my skis. We actually have not finished adopting the committee substitute, which again, both sponsors' office had worked on the changes. I remove my objection. Is there any further objection to adopting the committee substitute as the working document? Seeing and hearing no objection, the House Concurrent Resolution 9 version I has been adopted as the working document. Now, we did have public testimony notice, so I am going to open public testimony. I do not see anybody online or in the room. And just in case there was any confusion, I'll just note that there's also nobody online or in the room for House Resolution 6 either. So we're not missing anybody inadvertently. I am going to close public testimony on House Concurrent Resolution 9. And we are setting an amendment deadline for House Concurrent Resolution 9 for tomorrow, Wednesday, February 4th at 5 p.m. As a reminder, please draft any amendments you may have to version I. I would also encourage coordination with my office and with Representative St. Clair's office. I'd like us to continue working together on any potential changes for the resolution. And at this time, we are going to set the resolution aside until Thursday. That concludes House State Affairs today. Our next hearing is Thursday, February 5 at 3:15. We only have an hour for that hearing as a reminder because we are yielding time for the Department of Administration subcommittee. We will take up House Concurrent Resolution 9 again, as well as a committee substitute and continued discussion on House Bill 124 on ADA. With nothing else before the committee, we are adjourned at 5:10 p.m.